Welcome to part two of Broad Appeal, Julianne Moore, the good, the bad, the crazy. I'm Sean.
And I'm Brian.
Brian, do I have a doozy for you? You wanted a bad film? I've given you a bad film.
Second helpings of my own brain. I have been forced to eat my own brain. Ladies and gentlemen, we needed to find a bad movie with Julianne Moore. Now, granted, there are a range of choices. It's not as if the woman has a spotless filmography. I think, Sean, actually, your instinct for us to watch Hannibal, while I will never get that time back, and I will never have those images removed from my cerebral cortex, unless Hannibal comes and rips off my skull and feeds my cerebral cortex to me, while all of that is true, it actually became a fascinating object lesson in the same role, so memorably played by one actress, being taken by another great actress and failing miserably. We're talking, of course, about Clarice Starling, the protagonist of both The Silence of the Lambs, a great film, and this terrible film.
Yeah, so the moment we needed to think of a bad Julianne Moore film, I will be honest, this was an instant, instinctive moment.
Why?
Because it's not just that it's bad, or she's bad, or something's bad. It is an impossible undertaking. Actually, let me tell you how it could have been not good, but okay. You have Jodie Foster played, and it's directed by Jonathan Demme. The film needs a certain sense of tonal continuity, and this film throws up on the original.
Well, can I say, though, but you love the Alien franchise, which also Ridley Scott was involved in, where new directors have taken the template of Alien and put their stamp on it, some more or less successfully. But, you know, James Cameron was able to do his version of Alien.
No, it's interesting you say that, okay, but there's a couple of differences. One is that Sigourney Weaver was still in it.
Okay? Sure.
And second of all, it's not that it was tonally different, it's just that it kind of was a different subgenre of sci-fi.
Mm.
Whereas this is a rampant amplification. It was as if people who'd only ever heard of Silence of the Lambs had got together to make a sequel. Do you know what I mean?
That's really well put. So I'm going to have you be my Freudian analyst here for a minute, okay? I don't like scary movies. Since I've been with you, I've probably watched more scary movies than I ever have in my life. And I really was afraid to watch Silence of the Lambs the first time. And it's just as you're saying, right? It has this reputation that it's going to be this film which is about a cannibal, and it's going to be all about people eating each other and horrible, gruesome activities. I can remember, actually, the film being watched in my house by my father and my stepmother in the basement, and me not wanting to be down there.
Oh my god, the basement?
Yeah, we have a TV down in the basement.
You know, I've never been in your basement.
Well, you don't know what we keep down in the basement now, Clarice.
What, wine?
Yeah, there's a lot of wine, yeah. And a treadmill that no one uses. But at one time, in my adolescence, we did used to watch movies. No, I kind of didn't want to watch it, and I stayed upstairs. And eventually, later, I watched it on my own, I think deliberately in the middle of the day.
Yeah, I was just going to say. Yeah.
I think when I finally did watch Silence of the Lambs, Jonathan Demme's version of Silence of the Lambs is a very austere film. It is not a gross-out film. It is a film of tension, right? It's
yeah.
A film that almost makes you have these associations of the gruesomeness.
Yeah, and the scenes which are gruesome are very, very spare.
They burst out at you. And also, frankly, Hannibal Lecter is not really a main character. He is a weird mentor to Clarice. He is a integral part of the plot that pushes things along, but it's really the story of a young, untested woman gaining her authority.
Battling misogyny.
She sort of bonds with one monster in order to catch another monster.
Yeah.
Now, further full disclosure, I think probably Silence of the Lambs, while I appreciate its greatness, is one of two films that I have probably the most conflicted political reaction to.
The other one's Gone with the Wind, isn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. Gone with the Wind, I uncontrollably adore as a story of Scarlett O'Hara. And the older I get, I literally, like, can't deal with how terrible an influence the film has had in terms of how it depicts the Confederacy and just, like, a terrible, terrible, horrible representation of history. Silence of the Lambs, similarly. Like,
now we watched Silence of the Lambs on Valentine's Day.
This is our lives, ladies and gentlemen. It was a spontaneous decision. Was it last year?
I think it was, yeah.
Actually, do you know when it was?
Valentine's Day.
But do you know when it was?
When?
It was the day that we saw Julianne Moore at the Ritzy.
The same day?
It was the same day. We came home from having seen her do the Q&A, and we just put on Silence of the Lambs at home and watched it. I know this for a fact. So isn't that crazy? Isn't that kismet?
Reverse kismet.
We have watched the Silence of the Lambs recently, and like, all the protests in 1991 by Queer Nation and all those groups are absolutely right on. The film is very, very problematic in its representation of queer and trans identity. It presents a kind of weird pathology of gay sadism and gay or trans men being against women and wanting to destroy them and eat them. I mean, it is
and also really, like, really self-destructive as well.
I think what makes me feel so conflicted about Silence of the Lambs, and I'm drawing on a really interesting essay that the art critic and cultural theorist Douglas Crimp wrote about the
great
film.
Essay in Melancholia and Moralism, which was one anthology that Brian gave me when we first started getting together, and I passed the test.
Anybody who wants to read about AIDS activism, queer issues, and art, go read that. Crimp is really pointing out that there's two movies at war with each other. One has, like, this terrible representation of queerness, but then this other kind of coded butch lesbian in the form of Jodie's Clarice Starling, who is a feminist hero. And I think actually that is what saves Silence of the Lambs for me, is that it is fundamentally the story of this woman solving this case and standing up and doing the thing. So you can take the good with the bad, so to speak. Now, Hannibal, made years after by a different director, Ridley Scott, really the only element that carries over, right, is Anthony Hopkins.
Absolutely, yeah. Now, this is very tonally different. And
Oh my God.
And this is the argument as to why sequels shouldn't exist. You got a pre-packaged audience who will flock to it. And how do you get more people besides that pre-packaged audience? Well, you beef up all the things that people had heard about the first one.
Do you think that they wanted Jodie?
Interesting, we actually haven't turned to the Wikipedia pages for these films, but just before we started recording this, quickly skimmed through it, and I saw that Jodie Foster had been offered about $15 million to be in this.
And she turned it down.
She turned it down.
And she made absolutely the right choice. There's lots we could say about this movie. It basically involves a major effort to recapture Hannibal Lecter, because at the end of Silence of the Lambs, he does escape, he's on the run. One of his victims from the past who didn't quite die, played by Gary Oldman.
I have to say, my favorite thing about the film was Gary Oldman.
Well, we'll get to that in a minute. But basically, the general outline of the plot is that, like, that guy is desperately obsessed with recapturing Hannibal, getting him alive, so that he can then torture Hannibal to death in the most baroque way possible, right? He's
it's like, this is, you know, I think they're already looking for his ludicrous.
Ludicrous. Sean, yeah, I'll just say this. If I ever find a stray receipt somewhere around the house to a Sardinian pig farmer, I'm going to be very suspicious of you, and I will not stay in this relationship.
But darling, what about the truffles? I'm just thinking about you.
Gary Oldman is this rich old man whose face has been completely disfigured by his experience with Hannibal Lecter.
And can I say how disappointing it is when we find out what happened? Because you're thinking, oh my God, Hannibal ate the half this man's face. And then we get gauzy flashback as to what happened.
It's a cautionary tale for those of you who've been delving into the chem sex scene. Let's just say that.
I showed him my toys, my new setup, among other things. It's some way you sort of hang yourself, but not really. It feels good about you, Well, you know. Anyway, he said, Mason,
would you like a papa?
And I said, would I? Wow. once that kicked in, I'd fly.
Just to make matters worse, okay, Gary Oldman plays what we're told so casually is a child molester of DuPont levels of wealth, who has survived an encounter with Hannibal Lecter, who he thought he was going to get his rocks off with, and instead plays a little game of autoerotic asphyxiation, and then, in a moment of madness brought on by poppers, cuts off half of his own face.
Well, we all know. We've all been there on poppers, darling. I mean, you know, we all want to self-mutilate when we're hanging by a noose while someone's giving us poppers, and then having the bits of our face that we've carved off fed to a dog.
It is so gross.
I just saw Gary Oldman recently in Prick Up Your Ears. John Lahr, Wallace Shawn connection. He is great as a sexy, fun, young, queer Joe Orton in that. And here, he is just like this dreadful gay stereotype. It's like,
is he some kind of like, is he pathologically sexually damaged and deranged?
Well, yeah,
to but make him become some kind of criminal.
But that's the representation. Like, in these two movies, basically any character who's any form of queer desire.
Yeah, any kind of sexual deviation.
Becomes like a complete pathological psychopath.
I think the straight characters don't get a fair showing either.
No, okay, so that's Gary Oldman's basically.
We should also say that he's kind of also paralyzed for some reason. Is that explained?
Well, I don't know, when you've been hanging from a fucking noose and carved out your own face, I can imagine your whole body might be, like, slightly damaged.
So he is in heavy prosthetics.
Yeah.
Giving,
it's like little big man levels of latex.
Yeah, giving some wonderful kind of creepy southern... I mean, you know the type I'm talking about.
Oh yes, we all do. The Crypt Keeper.
Not too dissimilar from Tales of the Crypt. I really liked this character because I gotta say, no, let me tell you why. I love films that have double villain.
Well, he's kind of a villain.
He is absolutely a villain, 100% a villain.
Why is he a villain?
Because he's a fucking creepy child molester who, first of all, fucks with Clarice. He's part of the reason why she gets stricken from the Force.
Okay, we haven't explained any of that plot, but
we need to?
Well, can we just do it maybe in a sentence?
Okay.
Basically, Clarice has become a hotshot FBI agent thanks to handling the Hannibal case. She's never been put back on Hannibal duty. So recently, she's been involved in some drug busts and things like that, and this has ended up in this kind of stupid opening action sequence. Basically, she's in charge of a drug raid of a meth lab, and
the
other cops don't listen to her, and what happens?
Well, basically, she ends up shooting a woman holding a baby dead. Can I also just talk about their HIV problematic language as well? So remember, the woman she shoots, Clarice says, she's HIV positive and she will spit and bite at you, spit blood. And I just thought, oh my god, that is just so many levels of grotesque.
The sequel to a film that was protested by Queer Nation. They've not done their due diligence.
They've ignored it, they've not done their homework. But also, it begins like a James Bond sequence, just to let you, the viewer, know that this is not Silence of the Lambs.
No, it is not Jodie Foster running through Quantico. It is a fucking action hero sequence with Julianne Moore shooting that gun, with Ridley Scott telling her to keep her mouth closed. There's blood, like an agent dies. From that point onward, Clarice is on the outs with the FBI. It's not really her fault, because she gave the proper orders, but she was in charge.
Yeah, and some jerkwad man doesn't listen to her.
Yeah. But then there's an entire conspiracy within the FBI, spearheaded by Ray Liotta as the most cartoonishly chauvinistic. Like, I know that in the original movie, Clarice faced sexist attitudes and discrimination, but that felt real, and you were entered into, like, what it must be like to be a small, petite young woman in law enforcement.
Yeah, what it felt like in the first one was that the structural misogyny was more so, you can't do it as well as we can, whereas in this, the structural misogyny was, I am a monster, and I'm going to eat you up.
I'm going to comment on your legs. I'm going to stare at pictures of your boobs.
I'm going to
literally say lines like, there's so much country cornpone pussy around that I can get it anywhere I want, which is literally repeated twice in two different scenes. because it's such a memorable fucking line from Ray Liotta. And I mean, obviously, this is just setting up his character. I mean, I said to you at this point, like, okay, he's going to die in the most gruesome way possible, because he's just been presented as such a ludicrously, comically, woman-hating asshole that, like, then when he gets his scalp cut off and Hannibal Lecter feeds his own brain to him, we're like, okay, well,
I guess I should be happy.
He has no humanity. And this is like the level that this film operates on. Everyone in the FBI is corrupt. She has no internal measure. You know, like, where's Rod Rosenstein? Where's Bob Mueller? You know, this is honestly like, maybe this is
wouldn't Bob Mueller be running the FBI at this point? Just saying.
He might be. He probably was. Yeah, I think you're right about that. Like, justice for Clarice. Is Bob Mueller's investigation going to look back into this case?
Now, speaking of justice for Clarice, let's focus on Clarice for
a moment. Yeah, so I'm going to posit something to you. This character that Julianne Moore has been asked to play is not Clarice Starling.
No, it is not Clarice Starling, not just in physical appearance or accent, but in what Clarice was. Like, there's no trace of that.
But why? What do you mean?
There's a steely thoughtfulness to Clarice Starling that we see in Jodie Foster. The kind of person that thinks before she speaks, you know what I mean? And that's what kind of makes her so special. In this, Julianne is just a kind of action hero cop called Clarice Starling.
Action hero cop in that opening shootout. She's a bombshell. Like, I don't recall in Silence of the Lambs there being tons and tons of commentary about how gorgeous Clarice was and everyone wanting to fuck her, and like when she runs into Italian people, them being like, bella ragazza. Like, Julianne Moore is a gorgeous woman, we all know, and Jodie Foster, while an attractive woman, is a very different physical type, so that's something. But like, the casting of Julianne Moore in this part has emphasized the like babeness of Clarice Starling in a way that really feels reprehensible, and I know that we're then meant to like root for her to like fight back against the chauvinists, but I just can't help but think that the movie is just exploiting that, and the way that it plays out with her relationship with Hannibal is dreadful. Can you think of another example of a time when an actress as good as Julianne Moore has had to take on a part that is so intrinsically identified with another great actress?
Well, I mean, Alicia Vikander is playing Lara Croft soon.
Well, at least she has a different neck.
But to answer your question, no, not really.
And we praised Julianne Moore incessantly in the previous segment, but she can't overcome it, beginning with the accent.
Yeah.
I was raised Lutheran.
That's not what I asked.
This is Special Agent Clarice Starling, 514-3690, deposing Mason R. Verger on March 20th, sworn and attested.
Now I want to tell you about summer camp. It was a wonderful child.
We can get to that later.
We can get to it now.
But here's the thing. It is just an impossible task.
Yeah.
It is really hard.
Like, I would love to see the Clarice Starling who actually has more authority, because so much of Jodie's characterization is a woman who's not sure if she has authority and needs to grasp onto it. And
Holly Hunter would have been good.
Well, Holly Hunter had her audition when she did Copycat, it wasn't quite successful. But she knows she has to do the accent, because there are still like callbacks to the original movie, like Lecter saying things like, "You're just trailer trash, Clarice. Do you think that your daddy would be ashamed of you now that you're disgraced by the bureau that you love?"
Like, it is so...
"You care about the lambs, but the bureau doesn't care about you, Clarice." Like, and it's like...
Yeah.
So there needs to be this idea of continuity, so she still has to have that West Virginia twang, but you just don't buy it. I think we can skip over mostly the middle part of the movie, because actually, Clarice disappears from a long stretch of it.
Yeah, and that is the flipping of these two films, is that in the first one, Hannibal is very much the supporting character, and it's Clarice's film. And as a result, it's tempered like Clarice's. But you flip it around now, and it is this whole baroque, operatic, gauzy, gushing, gimmicky.
It's like the Medicis and the disemboweling.
So much stuff that's kind of like, there's set pieces. One set piece, you don't give a shit.
But what I'm, yeah, and I agree with you and all that. You know, I guess there's something to be said for this is the life that Lecter leads, and he's in Florence, and he's a scholar of Dante and fine wines, but he also is, like, you know, stabbing people and cutting off their balls and ripping open their innards and all this shit. But what I'm saying is, like, Clarice is just back in FBI headquarters, like, watching fucking old surveillance tapes and, like, looking up things on a rudimentary internet, and it's just like,
and that is so true. That is what she's been reduced to.
I know, and it's so dumb. So then, eventually, forces conspire to bring Clarice and Hannibal back together. He comes back to the United States after fucking shit up in Florence, and Gary Oldman is involved, and he's hot on the trail with them as well, and blah blah blah. Who cares? And this is where, if I didn't already hate the movie, I hated it even more. Clarice is taken from already a very passive version of Clarice, and she is literally becomes a damsel in distress. How does Lecter get her?
Well, I'll tell you what happens. She goes to rescue Lecter so she can do justice the real way.
That's right, because he's been kidnapped by Gary Oldman, who's going to feed him to those Sardinian boars who have been trained to, like, maul people to death.
Can I just say, at what point did the boars come to America?
Yeah, no, you have to... exactly right. That is a good point, Sean.
Now, Cordell will fax the veterinary farms directly to Animal and Plant Health, but you need to get the vet affidavits from Sardinia. Yeah. What's my name?
Uh-huh. Bene.
How are they?
They are big, Mason. Very big.
Say again?
Yeah, they are big, Mason. Really big. Maybe 270 kilos.
Oh, wow.
Presumably, they can't come on a plane. It would have to be on a boat.
And they'd have to be in quarantine
for
a while.
That would take a long time.
It's bullshit.
Yeah. So anyway, they come to America.
Yeah, and one of the ragazzos shoots Clarice, and she's injured. Lecter is freed. The pigs eat Gary Oldman. And Lecter flees to the house of Ray Liotta.
He's sort of drugged Clarice. Now, I guess there's a fascinating and interesting potential for this kind of dualism and this, like, twin relationship of, like, Clarice has saved Lecter and then Lecter has saved Clarice. But once he gets her to Ray Liotta's house, he dresses her in a low-cut fucking gown and Gucci shoes, and he just makes her up into, like, a fashion babe. It's creepy and weird. He's roofied her. I don't want to think of Hannibal and Clarice in that way. It's playing on this weird idea of him being in love with her, and she sort of awakes from her drug-induced stupor. She comes down. She discovers him having laid out this whole banquet, which is a ridiculously theatrical way to get Ray Liotta to eat his own brain. Ray Liotta is still living with the crown of his skull removed. Oof. And, like, his brain is being fed to him.
It's
and
Clarice, so disgusting.
That's disgusting enough, and I have to admit, I was watching it through my fingers. Like, I'm sure you've never seen me so grossed out watching something.
Well, I watched it through my t-shirt.
Yeah, it's gross.
Because it was just gross.
But I think what makes the extra level of grossness is that you have Julianne Moore sitting there, obviously looking gorgeous. She's Julianne Moore in a low-cut gown. She looks...
Boobs are super emphasized.
But this is the thing. When Julianne Moore, the real woman, decides to wear a gown like that to the Oscars, then I'm like, you go, girl. When Clarice Starling, FBI superpower, is dressed in that by men...
Forcibly
and drugged, and then just has to sit at a fucking dinner table with absolutely no narrative agency while men leer at her. I'm just like, what has this fucking movie been reduced to?
Yeah, it's so true. It is so true.
Ultimately,
but also, yeah, I blame Robert Harris.
Ugh.
And David Mamet. Robert Harris wrote this character in the first place, and then, you know, wrote this second book.
Can I just say,
decided to write a schoolboy essay about all the gross things.
I'm no defender of David Mamet generally, but at least he spared us from the truly terrible ending that you found out happens in the novel.
Yeah, so what happens in the novel, Hannibal Lecter presents Clarice with her father's bones, and then he psychically hypnotizes her to make her father's spirit appear to her, manifested through the bones, in which she can finally say goodbye to daddy. They then flee arm in arm to Argentina.
I mean, even the author of Glengarry Glen Ross knew that that just wouldn't quite cut it.
That wouldn't wash.
So instead, how does it end? So Ray Liotta has been killed.
Yeah.
And now Clarice is alone in the house with Hannibal. The police are on their way.
Yeah.
Hannibal's trying to escape, and they have this tense interaction in the kitchen, right, where he's like, would you ever take my life from me, Clarice? But you would take my freedom. And he's, like, playing on this idea that she is sort of weirdly in love with him and would never allow him to be killed. Yeah.
Tell me, Clarice, would you ever say to me, stop? If you loved me, you'd stop.
Not in a thousand years.
Not in a thousand years. That's my girl.
So he kind of has her up against the refrigerator. The one clever move that she does is she handcuffs herself to him, knowing that that way he can't escape. And he's got her trapped in the refrigerator because her ponytail is caught in the door.
Oh, femininity once again ruins lives.
So then it becomes like, how can he escape if he's handcuffed to her without the key? And what does he do?
Well, so we see a big meat cleaver and he says, choose, Clarice, above or below the wrist. And we see the knife being raised up. And I'm there thinking, oh, listen, I know what happens. And so he cuts off his own hand, sparing Clarice. She flees the house. In, of course, the dress.
Still wearing the same gorgeous dress and running out being like, Clarice Starling, FBI! Which is the last line in the movie that Julianne gets until we get this...
Yeah, there's no epilogue. Brian was waiting for an epilogue.
Well, there is an epilogue, but it's not an epilogue that explains what happens to Clarice.
Yeah, it's an epilogue on a plane of Hannibal Lecter feeding brain to a small Japanese child.
I know that the first movie similarly ended with a jokey little epilogue of Hannibal, where is he, in Haiti at the end of the first movie, or Jamaica, or somewhere in the Caribbean. Yeah. I mean, presumably this small Japanese boy is going to become his, maybe going to be trained to be his next cannibal mentor. But what I want to know is what happened to Clarice? Like, she's been disgraced by all these people in the she's just left hanging. Ugh. And the other thing that really annoys me is that she is saved only because Lecter is in love with her.
Yeah, that's right? Horrible.
Like, Lecter, every other person that he comes in contact with, he has no care for their humanity. He cuts off their faces, he eats them, he disembowels them, he doesn't give a shit. But when it comes to chopping off Clarice's hand, he can't do it.
Yeah.
So ultimately, it's a fucking princess Beauty and the Beast fucking story. And it's just about how much he loves her. And, like, the original relationship was so much more complex than that. And it has to be reduced down to she's just a helpless damsel in distress.
Yeah, who's in love with a man who makes her feel terrible.
Why? You know what I mean?
It's an abusive partner relationship. It's like, oh, he eats people, but I love him anyway.
Okay, I don't think we have to talk too much about the movie anymore. We'll wrap this up, but I just have a question for you.
Uh-huh.
Why did Julianne Moore make this film?
She probably got offered a lot of money than she was used to.
Yeah, so what had she done at this point? She'd had her early indie phase, which we talked about. She did Jurassic Park.
I think this was one of the first films where she got, at least on the poster, her name was also above the title.
Yeah, equal billing with Anthony Hopkins. So this was Julianne Moore testing her wings of, am I a bankable blockbuster movie star? It's a shame, I suppose, that it had to be in this material. Yeah.
I've got a question for you.
Yeah.
Do you think Gary Oldman should have got an Oscar nomination for this role?
Absolutely not.
No?
Gary Oldman is great. He's been good in many, many things. But I have to say, Sean, Gary Oldman under loads of latex, it didn't work for me in Bram Stoker's Dracula, and it didn't work here.
I thought that he was the scariest thing of the film.
Oh, he's fucking scary, but, like, I don't really think that's from his performance. I think that's from whoever
giving him half an eye.
Crazy, creepy fucking mask. No, nobody should have gotten an Oscar nomination for this. Definitely not the cinematography.
You know what? This is the beginning of the cultural wasteland of the early 2000s. It has so much kind of... I mean, I can't describe it.
It goes from
baroque, okay, to as if I filmed it shaky cam, then sped it up, and then turned the brightness up real fast
like
as well.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And I'm thinking, this is Ridley Scott? He also has his hits and misses, as we can well attest.
I actually don't think I've ever seen a Julianne Moore performance that I thought was as poor as this. It's sort of not her fault, but She just can't escape it.
It's her fault for saying yes.
It is.
That's as much as I'll say.
Thank goodness, though, that this didn't sink her career. I mean, there was probably a time around this period where it's like, is Julianne Moore going to go down the Nicolas Cage route of just taking big paychecks and leaving behind challenging roles? But we had so many more complicated, interesting, different sides of Julianne left to see. And one of them is the crazy film that we will round off our Julianne triptych with.
Yes, as ever, you can find out a clue on @BroadAppealPod. You can follow us on our individual Twitter handles. I'm @SeanMcGovernX.
And I'm @BMLNSpeaks. We will be finishing off with a dose of savage craziness very soon.
Okay, bye.